Good evening. Thank you for joining us this week for Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Regent. I'm your host for the first half, Diamond. University, with its impossible reading lists, expensive tuition, and intensively exhausting exams. It's no wonder why today's students are stressed and frazzled. But how are some of these students reacting to those long all-nighters? Well, it seems as if university and college students are turning to more than just excessive amounts of coffee, as students are now reaching towards ADHD drugs and other stimulants to deal with the academic stress, meaning many students are studying with the aid of prescription pills that are not necessarily their own. Joining us today are some guests that will contribute to our discussion about this growing problem in secondary schools across Canada. Welcome. So, how do you cope with stress, or how did you cope with stress during university and college?
I have a journal. I love writing. So yeah, that's how I can't.
Well, when I was in university, it was really a bit overwhelming. It was something new, a new experience. Mm-hmm. At York University. For that matter, I didn't really have much resources to cope, so I can't really say I can identify with taking medication, but I can understand the stress. Mm-hmm. And just the new environment of learning something new and the pressure to succeed in that, you know. It's a hard situation for students to have that pressure from family, friends, mm-hmm. teachers, professors, and just that was something that I was going through while I was at York University. So, eventually I couldn't really do well in school, so I had to drop out for not focusing and not being able to be attentive, but... I realized that if I had proper support systems, like being more communicative and being able to talk to a doctor, psychologist, or psychiatrist, mm-hmm. or going to the learning, the learning strategies that are offered on the campus, or the supports there that talk about learning disabilities and info about how it affects the person's mind in that environment, that would have been a huge help. So that's my positive direction I could have gone through that I feel mm-hmm. that people should open themselves up to.
Well, in saying that, how does that differ? How are your coping strategies now?
My coping strategies? Well, I'd more take deep breaths mm-hmm. when I'm faced with something, and sometimes I write a list of things down, a list of things that worry me down, and try and decipher why does it bother me. Like make a word balloon, and kind of just write down things that affect you in a way where you see a picture of it, and then you see it's no big deal. If you think about strategies, you can change that perspective of yours. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a situation where a friend of mine wanted to borrow money from me to go do something, and I was bothered about that. Well, I'd write down, the pros and cons of why I felt this way. And exactly what I'd be doing if I lent her the money and if I didn't lend her the money. And I weighed out the situation in my personal perspective that it was something new to me. It was something I hadn't done before. And it was something that I had to come to terms with. And I decided that it was just a matter of trusting her that I had issues with, that I've never really had trusted someone with lending money before. So I had decided I would lend her the money, and so things turned out for the better. I got my money back, and our friendship is still golden. So yeah.
Beverly, would you like to say something?
Oh, I was saying earlier, I keep a journal because, like, I love writing. Mm-hmm. So it really helps me with my stress levels. So, yeah, basically.
You mean writing things down.
Yeah, writing things down.
Or journaling.
Yeah, and listening to music as well while writing journals.
That's therapeutic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Would you like to say anything?
Sure. As somebody who went through university and finished it.
Yes, nice.
It wasn't something that was easy for me. I think where it starts in the high schools, mm-hmm. the guidance counselors.
Yeah.
Because through my experience, nobody told me that if you want to do this program, do this or do this. They didn't know, nobody gave us the pathways. They sort of just put you in this environment where you apply for college or university and then you figure it out yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And transitioning from a small little high school near Keele and Wilson to a giant York
yeah.
University campus was something that really threw me. So it made my first year really hard. As I went on to do it, it was easier, but the readings didn't get any easier. The stress didn't get any easier, and I resorted to drinking coffee and forcing myself to stay up all night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an emotional toll. Sometimes I can tell you right now that when I graduated, the night I came home, I burst out crying in happiness because yeah. it was done. It was done. I got my cap and gown. I came home, got my degree, and I walked in my door and I burst out crying. I was done.
Mm-hmm.
But as somebody who's gone back to college again for a second degree, I'm going through it again, and it's easier to cope,
yeah.
but still there's the stress, and I just wish that there was a bridge between high school and post-secondary so that there was support in between, because without that, the support in between, you throw a bunch of students who don't really know how to navigate. They're going to find ways to cope. They're going to take these prescription medications to keep up. They're going to do whatever they have to and drink insane amounts of coffee, even though they say caffeine is bad.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Yeah. For myself, I've started looking towards meditation.
Yeah.
It's a new aspect for me. Like, I've done yoga and meditation. Like, in high school, they would have, like, aspects of it in, like, gym.
Exactly.
Right? So, lately, there's been a lot of meditation courses, a lot of stress coping, mm-hmm. you know, workshops. And it actually really, works for me. I'm a very, I'm a person that thinks a lot. Like, I overthink a lot of things. Some people say I'm a perfectionist. So, just the thought of doing something can throw me off. Like, I get, I have anxiety about things.
Yeah.
So, having that ability to calm yourself down, just go into, a silent space and just listen to your heart and the way you breathe, it actually really works for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I suggest a lot of people try it out. Like, it's not for everybody, but, it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, statistics gathered by the Center of Innovation for Campus Mental Health, which is an organization who raises awareness about the mental health challenges that students face on ongoing campuses, state that 65% of students surveyed experience overwhelming anxiety in the last year, up from 57% in 2013. So what aspects of academic stress and university life do you think has changed or evolved over the years for students today to feel that they need to use stimulants to achieve academic success?
It's probably perfectionist, because everyone wants a good grade, and
yeah.
failure, if they turn to failure, they think that, it's going to discourage them to mm-hmm. go further. So
do you think over the years, the feeling of trying to succeed has, gone up? Like, I have to get these good grades. Do you think people are more aware of that today rather than 3 years ago?
Oh yeah, definitely, because it goes into the long term,
mm-hmm.
right? Good grades, they used to tell us good grades equal good jobs,
mm-hmm.
right? Good jobs equal high income and high quality of living. So I think, people are definitely aware of that. And it's not like 20 years ago where you have a bachelor's degree, you walk in somewhere and you're like, okay, I have this bachelor's degree, I'm qualified for this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, okay, here's this job. You're in it forever, and, you have benefits, all that. Now jobs are very precarious. You have secretary jobs. You have general labor jobs, and those jobs, they're not things that have benefits. They're not things that are guaranteed to maintain. No, they're not.
They're not protected at all.
They're not protected. Yeah. So you have students who are killing themselves, or students who have finished and have gone back, like myself, who always say, okay, I have to push myself and get this. I have to push myself and do this because I need a higher quality of living. Mm-hmm. Without that, you cannot survive in any sort of capacity.
You can't survive, period. You can't survive, period.
No, you can't. And it's a very bleak outlook, and people want to avoid that bleak outlook, which is why, again, it goes back to students using the prescription drugs to study and pushing themselves to get these A's, which is unrealistic, but it's just the way things have been.
And they stay hooked on the drugs as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Like, it makes them into drug addicts, right? Mm-hmm. That's why you got more young people on the street taking drugs and smoking weed all day. Let's be honest here.
Yeah.
Like more young people, especially, it's not because of the exams, it's because of the psychiatrists as well.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the Black community, they turn to three things. Number one, Jesus. Is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a good way, but there's a pros and cons to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of people where I work. I do security during the daytime, and I see a lot of young people doing like drugs, taking prescription drugs as well. But it's a way that you have to pace yourself on taking the drugs. Yes, you have to take the drugs, but don't make it a part of your lifestyle.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
Definitely.
Do you think maybe just because today how there's more people, more immigrants coming to Canada, so therefore we need more jobs. There's more competition for jobs. And because of this, the way they, I guess you can say, weed out through the people, do you think they build up higher expectations, like averages are higher for things are more competitive?
Yeah, I think it is pretty competitive to them, especially if they don't know English.
That's
so
true.
It's very difficult for them to either understand or speak our language.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of changing their education that they've earned from their own country is a huge aspect, like a doctor who has to take a job as a taxi driver because his degree doesn't
qualify for anything.
Yeah.
You see that a lot in Toronto, like especially Beck taxis, mostly every single one of them either are doctors, lawyers, or engineers. And they have the degrees and everything like that, right?
Doesn't translate, though.
Right, exactly. Give them jobs. They have the right to do what their craft is meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So nootropics, also known as smart drugs or cognitive enhancers, which aren't legal to sell in Canada, are drugs, supplements, and other substances that improve cognitive function. As more students continue to use prescribed pills to help focus during exams, etc., do you think that the Canadian government should just commercially sell nootropics just because there's more of an audience for it?
I don't think they should, because it would just mean another drug traffic situation again. I mean, other than meth being an issue, heroin being an issue,
fentanyl.
Cocaine.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, in places like America, it is legal. I believe Silicon Valley, a lot of people in there use it. It's, even though it's not legal to sell, you can still get it online for personal use. So you can, there's no laws for you having it on you. You just can't sell it in Canada. What are your thoughts on that?
I would rather the government not have something like this be open, because you have to think that right now Toronto's going through, and Canada up in BC out west, they're going through a serious fentanyl crisis right now. They're going through where people are overdosing on fentanyl, and then to have this on top of it would be a double crisis, and they can't even manage the first one. Right? You let a drug out there in the country that says if you take this you'll be smarter and you'll get A's automatically. It's a whole other situation, because again, goes back to the competition, goes back to people wanting the jobs, the higher quality of life. It's kind of productive. You take drugs to get that A. You killing yourself.
Yeah, it will catch up.
You lowering your quality of life to work for the higher quality of life you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's something that Canada should open itself up to.
Does anyone else have any other opinions?
I agree with that, especially if it's so open on the market, they should have an issue with businesses that sell this something, whether it's on Amazon or other places. I should take back that example of that company. I for advertising purposes, I'm just taking away that company. Sorry.
So, because you guys believe that Canada shouldn't legalize it, do you think that they should just ban having it, period?
Yes.
Yeah?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about it, yes. I would rather, for me, I don't like failure, but I would rather go through the anxiety of getting a failing grade than for me to put a chemical in my body. I don't know what it'll do to me. All I know that it'll make me smarter. I don't know what it'll do to me physiologically than for me to have taken this thing and, God forbid, died.
True.
Yes.
So,
because a lot of people don't know the side effects.
They don't know.
Of this drug and also ADHD stimulants. So let's talk about the side effects. There are many side effects to using ADHD drugs and stimulants, such as dizziness, nausea, lack of sleep, and loss of appetite. What are your opinions on the idea of universities raising awareness about the use of stimulants within school, and what might be the effective way to do this?
I feel they should come to high schools first. And,
that's where it starts, high school. Yeah,
high school, grade 12, grade 11, grade 10, those grades would have a big influence on how things would work out for people graduating.
And I would also say even that elementary kids, because they're preparing for high school.
That's true.
So
you said it starts in high school, so how would you go about doing that? Such as, would you have like workshops talking about it?
Yes, I would agree on workshops, presentations being done, something creative in the auditorium to keep youth focused on how serious it is for them to take this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you give a dry presentation, who's going to...
Nobody will care.
Yeah, nobody's going to open their ears to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to get parents' permission before you do this stuff, right?
That's true.
Yes, the PTA would be a good place to start to bring this out first to them and then through the schools.
So what about within the university or college settings? How would they go about that the same way as you said in high school? Should they implement any things such as you're not supposed to have drugs on campus? Should they implement you shouldn't have, you know, these certain drugs in here, or such as you need a certain, I don't want to say identification, because you don't want to, you know, kind of single out those that have ADHD, because that's not what you're trying to do, right? Mm-mm. But do you think there should be a process of having these things with you?
I think that the high school setting and the post-secondary setting is totally different, so how you go about it is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Within high school, yes, I agree, workshops, presentations, all that, because, you know, they're visual learners, they're kids that, you know, you show them something, it'll stick.
Mm-hmm.
But within the college and the university setting, in my experience, it's something that's really bureaucratic, so I think a process would be more effective.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Yeah, I think for the college and universities people, I think they should get inspected.
Mm.
So to make sure that they're not using any drugs, unless it's prescription.
That's true. So. But the thing is, a lot of people are actually selling their prescriptions.
They're
selling their prescriptions to individuals that are using it, that want to stay focused. There's side effects to this, as you don't know what you're going to focus on, you know, and because, you know, the prescriptions are special for those individuals, right? So we don't know how it will affect you if it's not made for you yourself.
Yeah, the dosage could have a huge effect on the person, whether high or low.
Yeah, that's true. And I read somewhere that it goes, obviously you're selling them, right? But it can go from $60 to how much you want, right? So it can, usually it ranges, like the price goes up when it's that, you know, exam cram time where you have exams for and essays for all these courses.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes up to, like, you know, so a lot of students are spending, you know, so much money, and a lot of people are actually using it. A lot of people are saying, yeah, I used to use it, and they experiment with it because they say it does help them. But, you know, aside from the side effects, a lot of people do think that it's worth it. So, according to the Canadian Center on Substance Abuse, other side effects can include an increase in body temperature, breathing rate, and in severe cases, it can start a change in the heart rhythm, which can lead to a blood clot or stroke. Just as nootropics are not legally sold in Canada, but can still be bought online for personal use, should the Canadian government tighten the grip on such drugs?
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah, the government should definitely tighten it. Like, for example, like, let's take the example of the 420 weed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Weed was an herb, a healing herb, right? And it was sold in the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Once the government got their hands on it, it's now legal.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows what they're putting in it now? That's the big question
here.
They're
mixing it with a lot of things.
Exactly, mm-hmm. right? But what I'm saying is, if there's something on the side, it doesn't make it right.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they could be adding, like, that drug with, like, what, aspirin.
Or rat poison.
Exactly.
You know, anything that burns fast.
Right, exactly. So it should be, I think, this is just me personally, all drugs should be banned, but unless you have a doctor's prescription by a doctor, a licensed professional, then you should have that drug. Other than that, no, period.
Hmm.
That's just my opinion.
I agree with that.
That's
definitely.
Just me.
Yeah.
That's interesting, but then you think about how they're going to implement it, right? So you want it to be you want it to be banned, but how will they keep that hold? How can you ban? That means a lot of resources they're going to need, a lot of people to watch.
Yeah.
The traffic of these drugs, right?
It's going to be tough. It's going to be almost nearly impossible. It's young people. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And also, adults are doing the same thing, too.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a 14-year-old kid say, you know what? I want my mom's, like, I don't know. This is a aspirin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And mix it in with their pills, also with alcohol. Let's mm-hmm. be experimentation, for example.
Yeah.
Right? Especially in high school, it's hard to keep it away from the children.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Kids are going to do things behind their parents' back. They're not going to listen to the parents, right? They're going to do, like you said before, it's going to be hard to control, but mm-hmm. I think it can be done.
Yeah. And the thing about this topic is it's not just the, you know, the immediate generation. Like, it's not the, like, you know, the first timers in university. This stretches and spans across
mm-hmm.
all academics. Everybody's using it.
It's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what are ways that you think a student should positively cope with stress rather than using stimulants?
They can talk to their counselor about, like, what's stressing them about school.
Mm-hmm.
There should be an online community that they can have a voice in if they find it hard to talk things out with a friend or family member because they're feeling embarrassed about it or... some people might tell them you're thinking too much about it, but
mm-hmm.
personally, they feel different about that. So there should be an online community for students to have a voice mm-hmm. on. So,
well said.
And more than anything, I think you touched on it, Diamond, the meditation and
mm-hmm.
the listening to yourself. I think more than anything, what's important is you have to start within yourself first.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do a lot of reflection. I know me from personal experience, I'm coping with a lot of stress right now. Self-disclosure, I have two tests on Thursday and my school's on strike. So,
oh, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
I'm in the middle of a college strike and I have these midterms and essays coming up. And for me, what I'm learning is that because I am a perfectionist, I'm learning that I acknowledge that I have limits and
mm-hmm.
sometimes I can't go beyond them. It's mm-hmm. just what's there. And sometimes it's okay for me to be emotional. It's okay for me to cry. It's okay for me to be frustrated because at the end of the day, nobody wants to have those emotional things, but it's a release.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a release. So I think you have to do a lot of reflection. Beverly touched on this, journaling, writing, listening to music. All those things help with stress.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you to our guests for joining us for our discussion. We are all out of time, so please stay tuned after this musical break.
can hurt. Loving can hurt sometimes, but it's the only thing that I know. When it gets hard, you know it can get hard sometimes. It is the only thing that makes us feel alive. We keep this love in a photograph. We made these memories for ourselves. Our eyes are never closing, hearts are never broken, time's forever frozen still. So you can keep me inside the pocket of your ripped jeans, holding me closer till our eyes meet. You won't ever be can heal. Loving can mend your soul, and it's the only thing that I know. No, I swear it will get easier. Remember that with every piece of you. And it's the only us when we die. Keep this love in a photograph. We made these memories for ourselves, where our eyes are never closing, hearts were never broken, time's forever frozen still. So you can keep me inside.
Good evening. Welcome to another edition of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio right here on Radio Regent. I'm your host, Judy Pham. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but for the I Am Project youth participants, the only word they are looking to capture is reconciliation. That's the theme for this year's I Am Art Exhibit, which partnered with the Native Canadian Center of Toronto to teach 9 youth participants photography and storytelling workshops to explore what reconciliation means to each one of them. The gallery will have its opening ceremony on November 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at the Daniel Spectrum Building at 585 Dundas Street East, right here in Regent Park, Toronto. Today we have founder of the I Am Project, Gilad Cohen, who will tell us a little bit about this exhibit and what it's all about. Galad, welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
There we go. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. A little tired. Yeah. This weather's very confusing. I don't know.
It is.
You know, I wake up, I put a sweater on.
And then you have to take it off, but then like midday you have to put it back on plus another one.
Terrible.
Yeah,
terrible.
It's confusing. Toronto's like that. So can you tell us a little bit about the IM project?
Sure. So the IM program, we started it about 3 years ago. And what it is, it's a photography and storytelling mentorship program that we offer to youth from underserved communities. We basically provide training to really top Toronto photographers to help them become mentors for youth. And then over the course of several weeks, we go into a space and we run these photography workshops. So what we notice over time is as we're doing photography more and more, we start to develop trust with one another. And people are like, is that just a photography thing? But that's just the basic nature of doing anything together. So with that trust, we sort of enter a next phase of the program where we start to introduce storytelling and personal storytelling. And so I'll get more into our organization later, but we're a human rights organization. So for us, with the stories, it's important that we're sharing a human rights narrative. So this year, the topic focused around reconciliation. And the way this all culminates is we take some of the youth's best photos, as well as their audio stories, and we set up like a proper exhibition here in the city, which rotates across the city, where those who are attending can see the youth's photos and also listen to their personal audio stories, hopefully learning a thing or two about human rights issues that are happening here at home.
Right. So actually, I know that last year you had youth that were Syrian newcomers. And so they had these audio stories in their native language. Is that the same for this year?
No. So what we found working with the youth this year is that most of them didn't have that connection to their native tongue anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the struggles of the Indigenous people here in Canada is that disconnect from their culture through the process of things like residential schools or the 60s scoop. So unfortunately, no. Only one of the youth in the program had a grasp of their language, but still not strong enough to relay that in an audio form.
So what's the process like? I know they're mentored by professionals in the field. And so how is that done? Like, are they provided transportation and food? Is this all free of cost to them?
Yeah, so we're really lucky. We're funded by some really good people here in the city. I want to specifically throw a shout out to ArtReach, who's been funding this program from the very beginning. But also this year, we have a couple more people on board, like Daniels Corporation, In Spirit, the Toronto Arts Council. So with that funding, we make the program completely accessible, meaning every youth has access to a camera, tokens, food, and then mentorship opportunities with each of our artists. So it starts off with us. We provide training to the photographers. We then go into the space. We do photography for a couple of days, storytelling again, photography, storytelling. And then right now we're sort of in the really boring part. Or not the boring part, I'd say, but it's the
media release forms.
No, not the media release forms. It's sifting through all the photos that they took. So last year we had a couple more participants. Last year, for example, we had to sift through 10,000 photos to find the 25 that we would use. So right now we're in the process of selecting those photos, editing them a bit to make them look real good, and then also editing the audio stories. So the gallery, right now we're also in the process of designing this gallery experience. So yeah, we're waiting for all of it to culminate on November 3rd.
So how do you pick 25 out of like a mountain of pictures?
So you start off. Well, you start off with a nice, big cup of coffee.
Speaking of stimulants,
yes, caffeine. Hey, so we work together. Like we pick some of the artists that are in the program. We just sit down together and we sort of look at the photos. We want to choose beautiful photos that we know people will want to purchase. I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but 100% of the profits from all the photo sales go directly back to the youth. So we do want photos that are beautiful. But then also we want the photos in a way to tell a story when you look at the photos themselves. You don't want to end up having 25 pictures of a streetcar or the CN Tower or anything like that, no matter how much you think that might sell. We want the photos to be diverse and to be beautiful sort of in their own way.
So how did you pick locations for taking pictures?
We leave that up to the photographers, actually.
So you give them a camera and then just, like, let them go where they need to?
Yeah, so we schedule the photographers, and then we just have them come together and pick a location. We try to tell them to pick diverse spots here in the city, diverse meaning they're different from one another. So some days we were out in nature, like at Evergreen Brickworks. Some days in the Financial District or City Hall. One time we went down to the island. We're trying to also expose the youth to new parts of the city that they didn't know was there. So like Graffiti Alley is I feel like every photographer's secret that for some reason the general public doesn't know about. But we want the youth also to become excited about the city that's around them and to see the city in a different way. So we try to pick unique but also diverse settings.
So you're sifting through the pictures right now. So what has reconciliation looked like so far in the pictures? Can you describe a bit of like the picture that they've gathered from that?
Yeah, so one thing I want to acknowledge is I'm not indigenous. I'm a white person, and so I don't want to offer too much about their perspectives on reconciliation or how that comes out in the photography. I feel like those who come to the exhibition will see that. But what I do want to say about the process is that the photography doesn't always exemplify what's matching in the story. So, for example, last year we were working with newcomers, and these were refugee youth, and the big question that we were having them answer in their audio story is what home meant to them. If home was tied to a place, or if home was a feeling, or if home was family, their responses didn't always reflect the photography. And the reason why is because we use photography as a means of building that community with the youth where they feel comfortable enough opening up to us about their stories. So, I mean, last year, it's up to people's interpretation. I mean, we were working with refugees, and a lot of people said that they saw the plight of the refugee through the photography, like they saw birds in the sky or people standing behind fences. I'm going to be honest, that's not some part of like a giant artistic genius vision. Back here. It just happened to be that way. So I leave it up to the viewer at our exhibition to piece that together themselves.
And what do you think photography does for the mental, emotional well-being of the youth? Like, how does it help develop them?
Well, photography and art in general have so many healing properties. I know for myself, if ever I'm feeling anxious or down and out or uninspired, I'll pick up my camera and just walk around. For me, photography especially is very meditative. I know the last host talked about meditation earlier. Photography forces you to have to be mindful of your settings, of everything that's around you, of the way the light is reflecting off the building or the way things are moving. It forces you very much to be in the now, which removes you from the stress and it removes you from the anxiety that you're feeling. But on a whole, art is so healing. You know, human connection and healthy human connections are so vital to improving the human condition. And art is vital to human connection. It connects us to other people, but it also helps connect us to ourselves. Ever since, I don't think you can think of a child out there who at some point in their life didn't play some sort of creative game or made a creative story or doodle on a piece of paper. I feel like it's within us to be artistic, and I feel like art just helps us connect to our deeper selves. It helps us understand each other more, which then in turn helps us connect to others more.
So how has the different cohorts of youth interpreted the program? Because they're coming from different experiences, right? There's this year newcomers, and then this year it's Indigenous youth. How do you think they've interpreted it differently or the same?
Really, there's been no difference. I feel like you can offer photography mentorship or arts mentorship to anyone. And it will be, I mean, if it's offered in a good way, it will be received in a good way. There hasn't really been a difference. The only difference I would say, amongst the groups that we've been working with over the last 3 years was last year when many of the newcomers had just gotten to Canada. Some of them were only here for a few months and didn't speak English. So we were nervous, like, how are we going to be able to deliver meaningful photography and storytelling workshops to youth who don't speak English? But photography just became the language. Art became the language. It's so cliche, but that's how we connected to one another. But from one year to the next, there hasn't really been that much of a difference.
So why did you decide Indigenous youth this year?
Oh, my gosh. Oh my gosh. So we, as a country, I'm coming at this with my human rights hat on, haven't been doing a good enough job acknowledging the pain that us colonizers have been putting onto the indigenous people. There's movements towards that, but it's still not enough. So for us as a human rights organization, we've been wanting to focus on this indigenous, I don't want to call it this indigenous issue, but yeah, this issue, I guess, of what's happening within the community for years. It just so happened that this year we were able to zero in on that. We were able to form a very meaningful partnership with the good people at the Native Canadian Center of Toronto. So with their help, walking alongside us every step of the way, we were able to start offering this program to their community. And to be honest, I couldn't be happier. It's Canada 150 this year. We are celebrating. We're spending a lot of money, time, and resources celebrating this country, and there's a lot to celebrate. Don't get me wrong, but there's also a lot to reflect on. Like for example, the plight of Indigenous people, the fact that there are over 150 different communities across this country. I think over 80 that have boil water advisories. Something like $500 million was spent investing Canada 150, but some of that money could have been used to ensure that everybody in this country has access to clean drinking water, and that's primarily lacking within the Indigenous community. So I couldn't be happier that this gallery and that the timing of this happened to come on this year, where we can take people's minds away from the 150 celebration and have them think about this country that we're on or in a little bit differently.
Great. So I know that you mentioned human rights and like the IAM project is part of a bigger human rights organization. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Jayu is my baby. We're in our sixth year now, so our mission is to share human rights stories through the arts. We were founded back in 2012. Originally for the first couple of years, what we did do, and this comes out of my personal sort of passion, was we were raising awareness of North Korean human rights issues. The fact that there are hundreds of thousands of people right now, as we're speaking, locked away in concentration camps in North Korea. It's illegal to leave the country. It's illegal to access. There is no access to the internet. We were raising awareness of all that stuff. And after a second year, we thought, you know, we've got this big, beautiful platform. Why aren't we opening this up to other people in the community who have a human rights story to share? So in 2014, we expanded the organization. We still stuck with the name Jayu. Jayu means freedom in Korean, but our mission is much larger than that. It's to use the arts and to use dialogue as a way to bring attention to human rights stories from across the world.
So why did it start with North Korean human rights and then branch out? And why did you decide to do the IAM project with youth?
Two really good questions. Shout out, Judy. Good questions.
Thank you.
North Korea. So in 2008, I took a trip to North Korea. I was living in South Korea at the time teaching English. I took the trip as an opportunity to brag to my friends, to be honest, about being able to go to a place that very few people get to go to. But also my intention was to come back and have a better understanding of what North Korea was, and the opposite happened. Came back. I'm pretty sure I hopped onto Google and I was like, I think I typed in like, what the heck is North Korea? And what I found horrified me. I found out a lot about those things that I was talking about earlier, but also it really resonated with me. It resonated with me on two levels. One, as a human rights activist, to not know really sort of humbled me in a way. But two, I grew up in a Jewish household. I'm Jewish myself. And a lot of the stories that I heard of North Koreans dealing with today is very much rooted in my own history. Things like concentration camps, mass murder, just violations of human rights. And so it resonated with me. And so I started working with North Korean refugees. And so all of these amazing things started happening. I got connected to a lot of communities, but the one thing I could never do was get my family really on board with what was happening there. I would send them articles and I would send them news pieces and I'd be like, yo, you guys have to care. Like, this is very similar to what we went through not too many generations ago, and they just wouldn't care. And so one day I put on this documentary about North Korea. My mom just happens to sit down and watch it. And when it ends, she breaks down in tears. And I was like, holy smokes, like film was able to do the one thing that nothing else could. And that was get through to my mom. So I was like, what happens if I was to take more films and pack a room full of people? What could we do? So that was the idea behind the Human Rights Film Festival. It started off in a living room with my mom, and then it sort of grew from there. Now we're entering our sixth year. We've had over 10,000-15,000 people attend our festival over the years, and it's really been a rewarding and great experience. And then the photography program is sort of rooted in that as well. It's rooted out of personal experience. Back in 2012, I was going through a really hard time in my life. I came across photography. I started to use photography as a tool to help me heal through some of my own personal struggles. And I thought, if photography has these sort of healing elements to it and it could help me, what about others? And it just so happened that at that time, I was working at a youth shelter. So that was my direct community. I was there every day. I thought, could it help them in some kind of way? And so we applied for a grant. Shout out ArtReach. We were able to do a pilot program that year with six really incredible youth, and it sort of just took off from there.
So do you think you would ever expand the photography project to people beyond youth, or do you think it's right now just for youth?
I think right now it's just for youth. We might do one-offs where we might offer it to other people. I mean, there's no reason why it can't impact a senior or an adult in the same way that it can impact a youth. But we are expanding the program, which I'm happy to say, and I'm glad that I'm here on a radio program in Regent Park because it's important to this community. But what we're doing is the program will be expanding from a summer program that's offered for just 2 weeks to a weekly drop-in program that's open to everybody. And the reason I say it's important to Regent Park is because it's going to be running out here in Regent Park beginning in February or March. So the first 6, 7, 8 youth that show up every week will have the opportunity to participate in the program. And then, you know, it all culminates at the end of the year with a big exhibition for them.
So where will it be located?
TBD.
Okay. And how do youth get become a part of the organization or the program?
So what we do is instead of sort of reinventing the wheel, we connect with people in the community who are already working with these people. So in the first year we went and we started working with a shelter, and they helped connect us to the youth that were there. We also worked with that shelter to help develop the program. Similar to last year, we were working with the Arab Community Center, so they helped connect us to their youth, and again, they helped us develop the program, and same this year as well with the Native Center. So for us, it's really important that we're forming these meaningful relationships in the community with the people who are actually on the ground and connected, because that way it's real. It's real that way.
I got a question for you, brother.
Yeah, man.
Why aren't you not in cinema?
Sorry?
Why aren't your movies in cinema, right? Like, the public needs to know about this as well. Right?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there is actually a movie about this. Are you asking why isn't this a movie?
No, why are your students or the people in the community doing this in cinemas, broadcasting it all over the world to see, right? This is amazing what you guys are doing, the organization.
Thanks, man.
That's my question. My question is simply, the government needs to get behind you guys, right? Mm. Seeing all the things from Hollywood making money, but you guys are doing something within the communities.
Yeah, so I'll answer that in two ways. But before I do, thank you. I appreciate that. So number one, last year we had two filmmakers follow the program, and they actually created a 10-minute short film, which you can catch on our website. It's on Jayu, jayu.ca. That's actually played in a couple film festivals here locally, but also internationally. It's screened in New York earlier this year. But the second answer to that is funding. As you said, so we're still a tiny organization. Right now, our capacity allows us to focus on photography. Thankfully, it's allowing our capacity to grow so we can offer photography year-round. But eventually, you know, as an arts-based human rights organization, we want to expand into other forms of art too, which does include film, teaching the youth to share their stories through film and then playing it. What better launch pad than at our own Human Rights Film Festival each year in December, right? So we'll get there, I hope. We'll get there.
Okay, and we're running short of time, but quickly, do you have anything else you wanted to add for listeners to know?
Yeah, so we just hope to pack the house on November the 3rd. As I said, 100% of the profits go back to the youth. So we want to treat November 3rd, which is our gallery opening, as a huge celebration for the youth and for the participants. So if you're listening, come out and show love. It's on Friday, November the 3rd, here in Regent Park at the Daniel Spectrum Building. To RSVP, it's free to attend. You can just visit jayu.ca/RSVP, and I hope to see you there.
Great. So thank you so much, Gilad, for being on air with us. If you wanted, just to reiterate, if you wanted to join the festivities, it is on November 3rd, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Daniel Spectrum Building at 585 Dundas Street East. And for more information, please check out their website and Facebook page, which we will have a link to on our blog. And thank you for staying with us for another edition of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio. Stay tuned, because coming up next is Murphy Brown right here on Radio Regent. And I will leave you with some amazing music.